The lecture tonight will give you a bird's eye view of how I got into the health and rehabilitation work, because I'm sure that this was something never intended for me. I certainly would have never dreamed I was going to do this 20 years ago. And in retrospect, when I look back upon it, it looks as if I've been preparing for this all of my life, as if by some predetermined force I knew I was going to do. When I was 13 years old, my interest in human body was such that I learned the names of all 206 bones in the body. I thought if I was so interested in the mechanism, I ought to know what the parts were. And I studied what I could in those days by reading publications like Science Newsletters and the other lay publications you got in those days. But I never took it seriously. It was sort of a hobby of mine. When I entered University of Chicago, towards the end of my second year, even though I had a scholarship in the university, which helped me, of course, with tuition, I had to give up before the second year ended because I couldn't raise the $5 a week for room and board by the end of the second year. So I went out then into the job market. In 1935, jobs were quite scarce. And they were so scarce, at least for me, that I never became employed. I've sort of given up hope of trying to get a job now. It's a little bit late. But in those days, I decided then to go into research and development. Research and development is a very polite term. That means that if you succeed at a project that you take for a company, they'll pay you. If you don't succeed, you do it on your own. So in effect, no one paid me for anything unless I succeeded. But it took me a couple of years before I learned how to do research projects to be successful. And in the beginning of World War II, I got a research project from the Air Force. And this entitled me to all the secret information that came from the various secret services and so on that they had going around the world gathering information. Now, I was very interested in certain parts of the secret information the Air Force had to offer. And that was in the death rates and the disease rates in the food ration countries in Europe. I was so certain that the death rates were going to rise so considerably because I was told then, and many people believed and still believe today, that stress is the principal reason for heart disease. And so I was looking for the deaths from heart disease to double because the stress was terrible in those food ration countries in Europe, England, France, Holland, and so on. The firebombing, the problems in the air raid shelters where they'd be burned alive when the firebomber would come in, throw a hot streak of gas, bring the temperature up so high they would suffocate in the chambers there. It was really a very terrible war. The population never knew when their children were going to come home alive from school. A lot of stress. And yet, 1944, in one of the most stressful years of the war, death rates from heart disease dropped to one-half of pre-war levels. It was astounding. And it was that way in all the countries under food rationing. In countries not under food rationing, like the United States, death rates from heart disease continued to rise and never showed a drop. And when the war was just starting to be over and the concentration camps were opened up by our soldiers, it was amazing to find that those who had been in concentration camps for the full 4 years, who had been diagnosed by the German doctors, who incidentally were very thorough, even though they were very cruel, perhaps, they were very thorough in diagnosing diseases. Those who had heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, 4 years after that kind of tremendous stress, they had none of these diseases. So even under the tremendous stress of concentration camps, the diseases disappeared. Well, it wasn't long after the war when I began to realize what the true story was, because when the food rationing was lifted, it only took a year or two after food rationing was lifted for death rates to rise and exceed pre-war levels. In fact, in Austria in 1957, there were 700% more deaths from heart disease than in Austria in 1944 when Hitler was walking all over the country. Well, after the war, when I no longer had access to free information, I was forced to subscribe to medical journals to get the second chapter, to trace these histories of the problems of heart disease. Now, during this time, I had graduated now to a full-fledged research and development investigator, and I started to accumulate patents. And through the years, I've got a couple dozen patents or so in this country and patents around the world. And some of the companies that license my patents, and they're principally in chemistry, physics, and electronics, some of the companies are Corning Glass Company, a licensee of mine, General Electric Company, General Precision Company, Bendix Aviation Corporation, the Honeywell Incorporated, the very large companies that can afford my sort of follies, so that I no longer was dependent upon the problems of competitive business. I was able then to work without any supervision, and in doing this, I probably devoted a fourth to a third of all my working hours reading medical literature, corresponding with medical investigators, and my secretary, for example, used to have a larger file on my correspondence with medical investigators than she had on my business dealings. And when I would plan to go to various parts of the country to seek out development contracts, I would first see where the medical conferences were going to be. And if I found a good conference, then I'd visit some companies in that area. If there wasn't a good conference, I wouldn't bother. I'd do my work over the telephone. So I, through the years then, worked principally, I guess, my greatest interest was in the work of the diseases, of what comprises good health, what nutrition's all about. And I managed to earn a living through other many years with the developments from the various large companies I used to solicit. Now, I lived in Chicago. I was born in Chicago. And in 1955, I was watching Dr. Lester Morrison study from Los Angeles. He had taken the diet from World War II in the food ration countries and given it to 50 of his patients who had heart attacks. And the other 50 patients, he gave the regular American diet that had been recommended for heart disease. That was started in 1948. Well, it didn't take long. By 1955, you could see that those on the American diet were all going to die off very fast. Well, those on the diet of the food ration countries, very few of these were dying. Now, the food ration country diet was reduced greatly in fat and greatly in cholesterol because these were too expensive during World War II to furnish to the people. Instead of 40 to 45% fat, it was down to 20%. Instead of so much cholesterol, it was down a third. I called Dr. Morrison, and I asked if he would mind if I could come out and visit him, and would he spend an hour or so with me to discuss his study and discuss the significance of his study and what he thinks about various cholesterol diets and so on. He said it would be fine, be glad to see me. My wife and I planned a vacation then around Los Angeles, went out, and I remember the night before I was to visit Dr. Morrison, we were sitting in a hotel eating our dinner, and I ordered a hot fudge sundae. I said, after I see Dr. Morrison, this will probably be the last Sunday I'll have, so I might as well enjoy it now. Well, I saw Dr. Morrison. We discussed his study and discussed the problems about high and low cholesterol levels and so on. And he said that in his study, the average cholesterol level of the patients before they started was 320. And after they'd been on his diet for a while, the food ration diet, it came down to about 220. And he thought 220 or so, 230 cholesterol level was a very good cholesterol level. Of course, in those days, we didn't have as much information as we had now. And he said, by the way, what is your cholesterol level? And I said, I don't know. I've never had it taken. He says, you can't investigate heart disease without knowing your own cholesterol level. And so he called his nurse. Before I knew it, her needle was in my arm, and she was drawing blood. And she says, we do it right in the office because we do so many. And in about an hour or so, she came back and said, your cholesterol level is about 300. And I said, 300 sounds awfully high to me. And he says, it's in the high normal range. He says, maybe you ought to get it down a little lower, but it's not bad. And he says, and how is your stress test? I said, I've never had a stress test. All my electrocardiograms have been done at rest. He says, you don't live on your back. You've got to have an electrocardiogram while you're walking. So he said, we have the apparatus in the office. Why don't you do it here? And they had in those days the master two-step test. You walk up and down on a little step, 20 times, 40 times, and then they do an electrocardiogram. My heart got up to about 110 or 120 a minute, and he looked at it, was sort of puzzled, and he says, it isn't quite normal, but perhaps it's not abnormal. It may be in the upper range. He says, why don't you have a cardiologist redo it sometimes when you get around to it? Well, that was about all that we talked about. I left Dr. Morrison, and I was very busy. That was 1955. And I finally, after trying to get my affairs in order, California is a very nice country, I decided to move from Chicago to California in 1957 to Santa Barbara, and we've been there ever since. Well, the first thing that I did in Santa Barbara was to seek out a cardiologist and check out the tracings that Dr. Morrison left for me. And I went to Sanson Clinic, which was the very large clinic in Santa Barbara, and the chief of cardiology at Sanson Clinic was a man just fresh from Mayo Clinic, a Dr. Claykeg. And I went to Dr. Claykeg, and I said I had a stress test done, and here are the results. I don't know if it's normal or not. I don't know how to read the tracings. And what do you recommend? He said, well, we'll do it over because my conditions are a little different than the others. And he did the test, and he said, you have coronary insufficiency. He said, you have posterior wall myocardial ischemia. He said, and you have to immediately stop all activity. I said, all activity? He said, you cannot walk upstairs anymore. You've got to nap every day after lunch. And you've got to limit your walking to no more than about 4 or 5 blocks a day for the entire day. He said, and if you're going to drive your car more than 100 feet away from where you're going to go, have someone else park it for you. I said, I can't be that sick. I don't seem to have any symptoms. I don't feel anything. He says, you better do as I tell you, or you're going to find yourself on a sidewalk laying down one day, and you won't get up. And he started me off on a medication. Well, the medication made my pupils open up. I had to wear sunglasses in the daytime, and it made me worse. So I did that for a month, and I finally decided that wasn't going to work for me. I stopped taking medication, and I didn't do anything. A year later, I remember it was February 1958, I got another blood value, and it was a very bad blood value. And I decided I really was waiting too long. I've got to do something to change my high cholesterol level. I couldn't figure out a way, though, to substitute my pint of ice cream I ate every night. I tried to figure out how to make it with corn oil and so on, but it never worked out. So finally, I decided I couldn't wait. I decided to change my diet. But how do you change your diet? I asked the various physicians I was in consultation with, and none of them could tell me what to do. They said they don't know if your cholesterol can be changed. They said they thought that was hereditary. And I said, well, I better go down to a school of nutrition and find out. So I went down to UCLA, and I saw someone in the nutrition department and said, I want to hire a graduate nutritionist. I want to change my diet, and I need someone to give me guidance. Well, they said that we'd be glad to give you a graduate nutritionist. They're looking for work. What do you want to do with your diet? I said, I want to lower my cholesterol level. Well, they said, you can't lower your cholesterol level by diet, because first you'd have to cut out some of the foods high in cholesterol, and they're the best foods that the body must have. They're the eggs, they're the cheeses, and so on. He said, you've got to have those foods. And I said, well, the animal studies tell me that if you delete these foods high in cholesterol, your cholesterol level will drop. He said, first of all, it wouldn't make any difference. What you eat doesn't determine your cholesterol, that's determined by hereditary reasons, and if you want to lower your cholesterol that way, we can't help you. It'd be too dangerous. You might kill yourself. I said, you mean it's okay for me to do it myself without your help and kill myself, but with your help you won't do it? Well, no, they wouldn't do that. They said it's something we would not attempt because it wouldn't be natural for me. I went to another university and tried the same, but the same answer. When they found out what I wanted to do, they said they couldn't take responsibilities for anything as abnormal as trying to change your cholesterol level. Well, I decided then to do it myself. But I was very fearful because I thought I'd go into various deficiencies. They warned me about all the deficiencies I was going to go into, and I really was worried. So I went to my friendly physician in Santa Barbara. He was my internist, and I told him that I wanted to change my diet. I thought my cholesterol level 300 was too high. And he said, well, it's only in the high normal range. He says he sees a lot of people like me. I said, that's fine, but I want to change it. Except I want permission from you to permit me to take blood tests at the local laboratory whenever I want to and have them give me the results. It would take me too long before you write out a prescription and I have to go there and then they send the results to you before I can make my changes. Well, I had to convince him that I would be able to interpret the blood values, and finally he gave me an open note. I went to our large laboratory, the Blanchard Dixon Laboratory in Santa Barbara, talked to Dr. Blanchard, and said, I have my note from my friendly physician, and I'd like to take a blood test. And he said, well, fine, let's take a blood test. What do you want? And I gave him my list of 90 blood tests I wanted. He says, what are you taking all these blood tests for? We only take 12 blood tests. And I said, well, I have to know what my minerals are, I have to know what my vitamins are, I have to know what my other values are, because I'm going to change my diet and I don't want to run into any deficiencies. I have to know where I'm starting from. Well, it took him about an hour to figure out how much blood he needed. Finally, he says, I think I can do it all with about 4 or 5 ounces of blood. I said, all right, well, let's take the syringe. He says, you can't use a syringe for this. You have to use a transfusion needle. We can't get that much in a syringe. And so he took his transfusion needle, put it in my arm, attached a rubber hose to it, and the blood just dripped into a bottle. Well, the sight of my own blood coming out in such volume, I nearly fainted on the chair. And when he noticed that I sort of turned white and was closing my eyes, he says, look, he said, don't worry about it. As long as you're sitting down, you can't hurt yourself. And I finally was over. He pulled his needle out. I got my tests. And then I started to change my diet. And it was really not that complicated. After a couple of months, I realized that I was no different than any of the animal studies. The same way that animals drop their cholesterol level, so do humans. And I never did run into deficiency on any of the problems at all. And I was just frightened unnecessarily. But it took me a lot of blood tests and a lot of worry before I finished with my experimental work. I remember the first blood test I took cost me $300, and that was back in 1958. So it took me a year and a half to bring my cholesterol from 300 down to 160, and another year on the same kind of diet that you're on to bring it from 160 down to 100. And it stayed pretty much from 100 to 120 these last 18 years. Well, now after 2.5 years, this was 1961 already, I finally solved my problem with my blood. Now, what do I do with my coronary arteries? That was the next problem. My physician did not permit me to do any exercise. But all the animal studies taught me that the only way you can grow new circulation is through exercise. So I was really perplexed. I went through the various studies, and I found one study of dogs that had walked on treadmills and another set of dogs that were sedentary. Those dogs that walked on treadmills had 50% more blood vessels in their legs than the ones that did not walk on treadmills. Well, that showed me that you can grow new blood vessels if you'll exercise. So I decided to find a capillary expert, a blood vessel expert that can advise me. And I looked around, and I found one in Los Angeles, one in San Francisco, and I was very fortunate to find that there was one expert in Santa Barbara. He was at the Environmental Stress Institute at the University of Santa Barbara. And I went to see him and told him that I wanted to grow new capillaries. What do I have to do to grow new capillaries? And he said, you can't grow new capillaries. You only have what you're born with. I said, but I have this study. And I showed him the study. It was in the original German. I had a translation made. He said, first of all, this is about dogs, not humans. And second, is this the only study you have? I said, it's the only study I could find yet. So he points to his wall. His wall had a bookcase from floor to ceiling, about 16 feet long, thousands of books. And he said, that will tell you can't grow capillaries. Well, I couldn't fight his thousands of books against my one little study. So I said, isn't there any way to gain new circulation? He says, no. He says, you have to be born with it. I says, but how about when people have a heart attack? Right in the coronary care ward, they grow collaterals. He says, that's the only exception. When the body is ready to die, it'll grow small collaterals to try and protect itself. But other than that, there's no way to do it. Well, that was very discouraging. And I went home trying to figure out what to do. When I decided to do more research on it, I came up with two other studies. But they're all animal studies, and they told me all the same thing. I decided I was going to then try it myself, with or without expert advice. But I was very frightened because my cardiologist had made it so clear that if I overdid myself, I was just going to drop dead. And I started then to plan an exercise program. But before I did, I had to have a way to test myself. I went back to my friendly internist. I said, look how well I did on my blood tests. My cholesterol is down now to about 100. I need to do the same thing for my coronary arteries. He says, what are you going to do? I said, I want to try an exercise program. He says, well, you know, your cardiologist said you can't do it. I says, but if it doesn't hurt me, I'll test myself. I'll take little stress tests every week or two, and if I find I'm getting worse, I'll stop. If I'm getting better, I can continue. And I said, I've learned how to read electrocardiograms now. I can read the tracings. And all I'd like to do is have the authority from you to go to our cottage hospital, have them do a step test, and let me interpret the tracings whenever I want to go. Well, he said, that's pretty dangerous. Something happens to you, it's my responsibility. But we went to the hospital together, and we did the test, and I read the tracings, and they were to a satisfaction, so he authorized the nurse then to let me come whenever I wanted to. Now I was ready to start my exercise program. And my whole exercise program consisted, instead of walking 4 blocks a day in 4 walks, I now walked 6 blocks a day. And I did that for a week or so. And then the next week I walked 8 blocks. The next week I walked 10 blocks. Can you imagine 10 blocks in 4 divided walks? It's amazing how frightened you can be when your doctor tells you you're going to drop dead. Well, I then went back and had a stress test, and I noticed I got no worse. And then I continued. I was walking further and further. I got to walk a mile. Then I would walk a half a mile at one time without stopping. And I found that after another month or so, my test began getting better. The abnormality was starting to disappear, and the insufficiency in the coronary arteries was starting to disappear. Well, this encouraged me considerably, but it took me a whole year doing that before I got up to walking 4 miles for the entire day, where I was walking about a mile and a half per walk, and only at a moderate pace. Well, by this time, the stress test, the little stress test, was getting almost normal, but I could only get my heartbeat up to about 110 or 115 or so a minute. I decided then to start to run, say 10 or 20 feet at a time. And I gradually got faster and faster until I now was running a quarter of a mile without stopping, when my right knee gave way. So I went to my friendly orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Burgess, who's still practicing in Santa Barbara now. He took care of all my children's problems, and I said, my right knee has become lame. I can't walk with it. And he says, well, you're probably playing football with your children. I said, no, we don't play football. He says, then what were you doing? I said, I am starting to run. And I ran a quarter of a mile, and something happened. I had to stop. He said, well, you can't run. You're wearing out all the cartilage in your leg. Your knees will just wear out. You'll have nothing left by the time you're 50. You'll be with a cane. He said, after 40, you've got to swim. I said, but swimming is no good for me. I'm not going to develop any collateral swimming. He said, what are you talking about, developing collaterals? I realized I didn't have a sympathetic ear, so I didn't try to explain it. And I said, there must be some way I could run. Maybe I can change my shoes or change my gait, or maybe 1 foot is shorter than the other. He says, no, people over 40 can't run, and that's all there is to it. Well, that was coming right from the authority, and I decided I'd have to take his advice. I waited a couple weeks, and my knee finally healed. And I just, as a last time, I thought I would just have the last experience of running while I had some conditioning. And I went out to the grassy field, threw my shoes off, and ran in my stocking feet. And I was amazed. I ran for a quarter of a mile with no pain. And I continued, and I ran another quarter of a mile without pain. At that time, I realized that you can't run in street shoes. I used to wear hush puppies then. And I realized they were my problem for my bad knee. I had a pair of shoes made, because in those days, running shoes were not like you have today. All they had are some very strange-looking shoes they used to use for sprinters, and there was practically nothing else available. Well, the pair of shoes I had made worked fine. I never had a knee problem again. Well, I gradually developed more and more running skill, and I got up to running 4 miles without stopping. And I finally got to the point where I was running 7 or so miles without stopping. Now, this took a long, long time. You won't believe how slowly I did this. It was 1966 before I got up to 7 miles without stopping. That was five years after I started. 5 years. If I had to do it all over again, I'm sure I could do the whole thing in about 6 or 9 months. But I was being very, very cautious. I thought I was going to drop dead. I thought all kinds of things would happen. Tested myself very frequently, and it really concerned me. I thought it was time now for a real stress test. So I went back to UCSB, our Santa Barbara University, back to the Institute of Environmental Stress, to the same doctor that gave me my capillary advice. And I said, you have a treadmill here. And I'd like to have a stress test on a treadmill. I need to get to my highest heartbeat to see if I have any coronary insufficiency. He said, sure, I'll be glad to do it for you. We have an experimental treadmill. It's given to us by the Air Force. And he showed it to me. It looked like they tested cows on it. It was 3 feet wide by about 10 feet long. Very elaborate equipment. He says, if you can get yourself a cardiologist, I'll be glad to test you, because we can't take any responsibility if you drop dead. So I said, that'd be fine. And I got myself a cardiologist. He came down, and we're all ready to go. I took my shirt off. I said, I'm all ready for the electrodes. And he said, are you going to run in those long pants? I says, I always run in long pants. He says, but it's different here. You're going to be standing still while you're running, and you won't have any breeze that you create. You know, outside, when you run, you move forward and get a breeze. Here, you're going to stand still. Only the treadmill moves. So I said, fine. And he gave me a pair of shorts, and I put them on. And he said, well, we're practically ready. And I said, well, I'm all set. And so I got on the treadmill, and he says, no, no, we're not that ready yet. He says, you've got to have your preliminary tests. I said, what tests? I just wanted to run on the treadmill. He says, this is a scientific laboratory. First, we have to take your temperature. I said, why do you have to take my temperature? He says, because you're going to gain some temperature, and we have to see how many degrees you gain. I said, fine. All right, so open my mouth. His nurse comes, and she says, we don't take temperatures that way. It's not accurate enough. So she said, bend over. Well, I thought, for the sake of science. And so I bent over, took my temperature. She said, it's 99.5. She says, you know, rectal temperature is 1 point higher than oral. I said, thank you. I'm very glad to know about that. And so I said, I think I'm ready now for the treadmill. She says, no, no, we have to weigh you. I said, why do you have to weigh me? She says, because you're going to lose weight. You're going to lose water. We've got to know how much you lose. So she weighed me, and I said, I hope everything's all right. And I said, I hope I'm ready for the treadmill now. And she says, yes, you're all set. But, you know, right after the treadmill, we have to quickly do this all over again before things change. And I thanked her. So I got on the treadmill, and the doctor asked me what protocol I want. That is, what do you want? How do you want us to set up the treadmill? And fortunately, I had such good equipment, the wires were not directly connected to the recording device. There was a little radio transmitter that sent the signal 10 feet away to his recorder. And he could record my tracing in slow motion. Instead of 1 inch a second like we do it here, he was able to do it 2 inches a second. It gave him much easier tracing to read. And I said, what I'd like to do is run on the treadmill at 8.5 miles an hour. That's 1 mile in 7 minutes, and I want to run for 20 minutes because that's what I'm accustomed to doing. So I want to run 3 miles on the treadmill, and I'd like to run the tape continuously so I have a record of every heartbeat. He said, all right, he can do that. So we get started, and the treadmill starts to go at a walking pace, and then starts to go a little faster, and I have to start running a little bit. Finally, I'm up to 8.5 miles an hour, and I was very glad that they had me put the shorts on, because even though you're running, you're standing still. There's no wind at all, and the sweat came down me in such a fury that my socks were getting wet. Well, when the 20 minutes were up, the treadmill started to slow down gradually. I was very, very happy. I can't tell you how happy I was for that treadmill to slow down. Finally stopped. I was trying to catch my breath when the nurse says, bend over. And then she says, your temperature rose 2 degrees. I said, it'll cool down later. And then I'm trying to catch my breath. She says, we have to weigh you immediately. I says, can't it wait? I said, I'd like to see the tracing. She says, no, we have to do it already. She says, you lost 2.5 pounds. I said, I'll drink it back. It's only water. So meanwhile, the good doctor is looking over the tracing, just like a broker in a stock market office where the ticker tape is all over the floor. Looking at the tracing, and I'm looking over his shoulder. I said, do you find any coronary insufficiency? He says, not yet. But he looks and looks. He did the whole thing, and I said, well, let's do it over again. So he started to do it backwards and went over every heartbeat. We couldn't find one beat with coronary insufficiency. The heart rate got up to about 177 beats a minute after about 8 minutes and stayed there the whole time. And I said, why don't we find any coronary insufficiency? I said, the only way that could happen is if I must have more blood. He said, well, you probably have more blood. I said, where do you think it came from? I said, is it possible I could have developed collateral circulation? Well, by this time, it was 5 years later, and the evidence was coming so strong that activity gives you collateral circulation, he finally broke down and said, well, it's possible. But it didn't make any difference where the blood came from. I knew that I no longer had coronary insufficiency at the highest rate that I could run, and I felt that finally, from 1958 to 1966, an eight-year effort, that I was finished with my health problem. Well, I can't tell you how elated I was. And immediately I tried to convert everybody in the world to a new way of living. And I remember the first man I tried to convert was at a party. He was telling everybody he's discovered he had coronary insufficiency, he was having some chest pressure, and it was worrying him. His doctor put him on certain medication. So I said, how would you like to cure your coronary insufficiency? He says, fine. He says, are you a doctor? I said, no. He says, well, don't bother me then. I got a doctor, and he's taking care of me. I realized that my advice really wasn't wanted because I had no credibility. Well, from that point on, I didn't say much. But the doctors in town, Santa Barbara's a small town, knew I was very interested in nutrition, used to refer me a patient every now and then to give them a nutritional prescription. They thought I'd give them a vitamin or two and keep the patient happy. Well, when I'd get a patient who had high blood pressure, I used to, in very short time, get rid of his high blood pressure. That was the last time I got a referral from that physician. It got so that the only physicians that refer patients to me were the psychiatrists. They never lose a patient. And one of the psychiatrists who used to refer patients to me invited me to attend a medical meeting with him. And I noticed that he had a little lunch basket with him. But I didn't say anything because people are entitled to bring their lunch to a medical meeting. We sat in back, and we're there about 10 minutes when he opened up his lunch basket and took out a chicken leg and started to chew on the chicken leg. I said, you obviously like chicken legs. He says, I hate chicken legs. I says, but you got about 10 chicken legs in your basket. He says, that's because I've got hypoglycemia. I have to eat chicken eggs. I said, don't tell me you're on that high-protein diet. He says, of course I'm on a high-protein diet. It's the only diet there is for hypoglycemia. He says, I've had it for 10 years. And I said, and you'll have it for the rest of your life because that's a wrong diet. You've got to be on a high-carbohydrate diet. He says, no, he says, that's what causes hypoglycemia. You've got to be on a high-protein diet. I says, that's guaranteed to have hypoglycemia for the rest of your life. I said, why not try a little different approach? Well, he says, look, I got my diet from an expert. Someone's been treating this for 25 years. I've been around the country. All the advice is more or less the same, and you just don't know what you're talking about. Well, it took me a couple of months before I convinced him to go into the studies with me. He used to come over to my house, and we went over hundreds of studies. And finally, I convinced him to at least to try this new approach. And he was really worried about it. And he decided to try it. 10 days after he was on the diet, he called me up, very worried, and he says, I'm having lots of trouble. I said, what's wrong? He says, I can't take my afternoon nap. I said, why not? He says, I can't fall asleep. I says, you're cured. Go out and play tennis. Every day this poor guy was taking an afternoon nap, he was absolutely exhausted by noon. It interfered with his medical practice, but he couldn't help it. He was always fatigued. Well, this was such a sensation to him. He called up his physician in Pasadena, that was the hypoglycemic expert, and told him all about the diet and told him all about the whole medical approach. Well, the physician could hardly believe it. He's been treating cases like this for all these many years, and this diet was completely 180 degrees away from where he had been treating. So the physician called me up and says, my patient tells me that you put him on a strange diet, a high-carbohydrate diet yet, and that his hypoglycemia seems to be better. He says, how can you scientifically justify such a diet? He says, I'd like to have you come to my office. Wednesday's my day off. We'll spend an hour or so, and you give me your evidence why you do this. Well, that worried me because no one had ever cross-examined me who was a physician, and it worried me considerably. So I prepared for it by getting about 600 studies together. I brought them in a little folder, a little filing cabinet, cardboard filing cabinet, brought them down to Pasadena. And I met the physician at his club for lunch. We were there 6 hours. I went through the many, many studies. When I was finished, he was so convinced that this was the way to go. He says, you know, I can't believe it, but I'm so convinced I'm going to change my whole practice to suit your nutritional approach. and I want you to help me. I says, how will I help you? He says, I want you to come down and act as my consultant for a couple of days till I get used to the whole idea. So I didn't quite know what he meant by that, but I came down, and he says, well, we're ready to see a patient. I says, what do I do? He says, first you put this white coat on. So I put the white coat on, and I say, what do I do? He says, you're my consultant. You go down and just listen to what the patient has to say. We'll both go together. And then you would listen to what the patient says. You think about what diet you want to advise. We'll walk out of the room, tell me what the diet is, and I'll go back and tell the patient. So we walk in the room, and we listen to the patient's problems, and then we find out what diet she's on, and it's a terrible diet. And so we walk out, and I says, no wonder she's sick. This is what she's eating. She's got to eat this, this, and this. We walk back, and he tells the patient, well, you have to eat this, this, and this. And the patient says, well, how much should I eat of this, this, and this? And we walk out, and I say, this is how much she should eat of each one, and so on. And we walk back. Well, but he was very bright, and he caught on very fast. And it just took a couple of days of consultation before he was doing it himself. Well, during this time, I had been treating one or two or three other people who took it seriously. One of them was Mrs. Eula Weaver, who at that time was the woman who, at 81, had congestive heart failure and all her problems. And a couple of years later, she ran her first mile. Well, the doctor in Pasadena called me up one day. He says, I'm the president of a medical society, and we're going to have our annual meeting in Florida. How about coming out and giving a lecture to our group? I said, how many people you have? He said, oh, several hundred. I said, what will the audience be made of? He said, there'll be physicians and scientific investigators. I said, where will they come from? He said, all over the world. I said, well, who's on your program? He said, well, we'll have various physicians lecturing. And I says, only physicians? He said, I might have a PhD or two. I says, but who will you have that has no credentials like myself? He says, you'll be the only one. He says, but that's all right. He says, we need to shake them up a little bit. Well, this really sounded like a threat, but I thought I might as well do it. I've never appeared before more than one physician at the time, and he was the physician I appeared before. And my wife and I prepared this for 2 months. For 2 months, we did nothing but prepare for this one-hour talk. We typed it over 8 times, I think. We had hundreds of studies supporting what we said. And we went down then to Florida, and we had 2 suitcases. One weighed 80 pounds, that was our references. And the other was a small one for our clothes. We went to the hotel and got all our references out in order so I can immediately get to them if anyone challenged me at any point. And it was my turn finally to give my talk. I got up, gave my talk, and I never saw such a bunch of people that had glum looks in their face. I could see that they were not taking seriously what I said. That is, it didn't look like anyone was even listening to me. And after my talk, when they asked for questions and answers, nobody asked the single question. Well, I knew then that I was really not wanted, and I told my wife, I think we ought to leave. We certainly are not wanted, because they didn't ask a single question. So I went to see the doctor, who was president of the group. I said, I think we're going to leave. I know your meeting's another day or two, but it doesn't look like the talk was really accepted. And I must have hurt some people's feelings, because what I told them was exactly the opposite of what they believed in. He says, no, he says, would you stay another day? I'd like you to give a workshop. So I said, what's a workshop? He says, well, you sit around a table and half a dozen physicians come and ask you questions, and you answer the questions. It's a very informal meeting. I said, all right, we'll give a workshop then. Next day, I'm ready for my workshop, and I go to the secretary and ask what room it's in. She says, it's in room so-and-so. I walk in room so-and-so, and I open the door. The room is filled with about 150 people. There weren't enough chairs, so many of them were standing against the wall. I opened the door, and I closed it within 5 seconds, walked right out. And I went back to the secretary, and I said, you gave me the wrong room. I says, I'm supposed to give a workshop. Half a dozen people around a small table. He says, there's only 2 workshops, yours and someone else's, and that's your room. Well, I walked into the room, and I had a crowd against the wall and the people standing up. I got to the other end of the long table, and I sat down, and I didn't know what to do. And the physician next to me introduced himself, and I said, what do I do? He says, stand up and ask for questions. So I stood up and asked for questions. About 20 people raised their hands and asked questions. And then I realized what was wrong the day before. the kind of nutrition I was talking about was so different from anything they'd ever heard, they didn't know what questions to ask me. And now the questions came out just like a torrent. And I realized that physicians, at least this group of physicians, were completely oblivious to the nutritional factors that cause degenerative diseases. They understood vitamins and minerals as far as prescribing. They knew about low-salt diets and the American Heart Association diet, American Diabetic Association diet, but they didn't have the slightest idea what the relationship was to disease. Well, at the end of that, about 16 physicians asked if I would give them special diets to put their patients on, and that many were willing to join a study. Each was willing to put 25 patients on a diet. Well, that was a nice study. 25 times 16, that's 400 patients on a diet. Told my wife about it, she said, that'd be terrific. It'd be a nice study. We would write manuals for the patients and a manual for the physicians, and it sounds like it'd be fine. So that went very well, and a man came up to me and he says, I'm a cardiologist. I'm having present of a meeting, cardiology meeting, that's going to follow this one. I'm here a day early for the arrangements. Would you talk to our group? I said, sure, I'd be glad to. He says, now since you're unscheduled, you'll come on as the last speaker. You'll come on at 9 o'clock in the evening. I said, that's fine. Well, I gave the same talk, 9 o'clock in the evening. They asked for questions. Again, there were no questions. So I said to the moderator, I said, why don't you say I'll be around the table and back, and if anyone wants to ask me a question, I'll be there after the meeting. So I sat down after the meeting, and people then surrounded the table about four deep. There was such interest in the whole concept that nutrition can cause heart disease. And I picked up another 10 physicians who wanted to put 25 people on a diet. Well, now I was getting a fair-sized study. We had about 600 patients who were going to go on this sort of diet. Well, the American Medical Association heard about it, and they said, how about us printing a notice in our journal of the American Medical Association inviting our readers to join your study? Sounds like an interesting study. So I said, that's fine. I didn't realize how many physicians they reached through that journal, American Medical Association, until the letters came in. 1,000 physicians wanted to join our study from all over the world. I didn't realize they sent it out to a couple 100,000 physicians. Well, that, of course, overwhelmed us. We just couldn't handle it. This is a study my wife and I would finance, and it wasn't possible to handle that. So we stopped at 60 physicians in 22 states, 2,000 people. And it cost my wife and I about $25,000 to do the study, but it was well worth it. It was a 12-month study. We had to print all the manuals for the patients and the physicians and the forms, and all the blood went to bioscience laboratories. A very interesting study. Well, meanwhile, we got a letter from a physician at the Long Beach Veterans Hospital. It's the largest VA hospital in the world. And the letter said, I'd like to invite you to do a study. It'll be on patients at our hospital and those with serious heart disease. And we'd like to see the effect of diet on heart disease to see if it affects them or not. And we're going to do angiograms before and after the study. Well, angiograms, that's something I always hoped I'd be able to get on a study for. An x-ray of the inside of the arteries to see what effect the diet might have on the arteries. I called him right away and said, how soon are we going to start the study? And he told me what it was. He came over to my house. We gave him a sample meal. He said, that's fine. He says, we'll select about 40 people. And what we'll do is take 20 of them, put them on your diet, 20 on the American Heart Association diet. We'll select them for claudication, not enough blood flow in the legs, so we can test them on a treadmill to see how well they do. Well, that was fine. And we're ready to start the study, he said, about September 1974. Well, it came the time to start the study, and he calls me up and says, the hospital's loading so many responsibilities on me, I don't have time to select the cases. Can you come down and help me? I says, be glad to. Came down, and I said, where are the ones you selected? He says, I haven't selected them yet, but here's the pile of cases to go through. Well, I was there for 3 days. I went through many, many cases, and I finally found two people willing to enter the study. I said, at that rate, I'm not going to get very far. I had a son, Robert, who was 23 at the time, working as a diabetic investigator for an Eastern Diabetic Foundation. He was at Stanford investigating their diabetic work. I said, Robert, you have to come down for a couple weekends for me. He came down, we went over cases. It took us 8 weeks, 3-day weekends, to go and get our 38 patients. We went through 800 case histories to get them. Because when you get your cases, you have to match. Your two groups of 19 have to be matched for diseases, length of time they had diseases, severity of disease. It wasn't easy. We finally finished it. We sent the men in for their blood tests. They did their treadmill tests. All the examinations were done. Finally ready for their angiograms. Well, at that time, unfortunately, the Long Beach VA had a problem. The chief of cardiology apparently had run into problems doing coronary angiograms, and there were some deaths, as I understood it. So they cut off all experimental work on angiograms. And they said, well, if you want to have angiograms, you'll have to apply for an approved study and apply for a grant to get the funds to do the angiogram. I said, well, how long does it take? They said, well, you can probably get approval in 9 months. I said, 9 months? Our patients are dying at the rate of about once every 3 weeks. We won't have any left in 9 months. Well, they said, that's the best we can do for you. He says, why don't you buy them on the outside if you need them that badly? I said, how much are angiograms? And they said, $1,200 a piece. Well, I knew I couldn't afford that. So I decided then to talk to many hospitals, many investigative groups, universities. I finally got Loma Linda University interested. And they said, if you're willing to do it, we'll do the angiograms for you because we like the diet that you're planning. But we'll charge the insurance policies of the patients with the price of the angiogram. Whatever they don't pay, you'll have to pay yourself. Well, I was willing to do that because that was a lesser amount of money. And I then took that on. Finally got all the angiograms done. And I said, well, let's get started right away now. Let's get the diet started with your dietitian. He said, fine, let's go to the chief dietitian. I go to the chief dietitian, and I give her my diet. She said, no, don't bother me with the details. Is it a low-salt diet? I says, no. She says, is it an American Heart Association diet? I says, no, it's a special diet. And I finally go through the diet, and she says, we can't do it here. I says, why can't you do it? She says, let me show you my kitchen. I walk into the kitchen. It's a very, very large room. The smallest pot is 4 feet in diameter. And she says, we can't make a specialized meal like this for only 18 men. And I says, well, do it in your experimental kitchen. She says, we have no experimental kitchen. I says, it can't be in a hospital this size, the largest VA hospital in the world. You don't have another kitchen but this one. She says, well, if you find one, you can prepare the food there. Well, I went to the hospital. I was there for 2 days. I tramped every floor of that place, 20 acres of area. There wasn't even a hot plate around. Well, that was very bad because now I'm ready to do the study. We got the angiograms. The men are very sick, and I can't feed them. Well, I decided I was going to feed them at my own expense. I rented a house in Long Beach, 2 miles from the hospital, outfitted a kitchen, prepared to buy all the food for 5 months. But I realized when I figured up what my expenses were that I didn't have enough money. It was going to cost about $35,000 for me to do it, but I needed $10,000 for a coordinator who would live there and run the study for me. And all my wife and I could see what we can have coming in the next 5 months is about $25,000 we could spare. So this was bad. I was going east, and I stopped by the National Institute of Aging in Washington because I had met Dr. Schock, who was head at that time, some time ago. And I told him about this marvelous study with angiograms. We're going to prove whether or not heart disease has any effect by diet. I says, but I need $10,000. He says, terrific. Just apply for it. Go see Dr. Butler, who's in charge of our funding. I thought this was marvelous. I called Dr. Butler, who incidentally today is director of the National Institute of Aging. And he says, terrific. Apply for a grant. I says, a grant? How long does it take? He says, maybe we can get a decision in 9 months. I said, I can't wait 9 months. Don't you have emergency money? He says, yes, once you get a grant, you can get emergency money. Well, I contacted 50 of the largest health foundations in the country by phone. They said, are you connected with a medical university? I said, no. They said, are you an MD? I said, no. They said, what are you bothering this for? I said, but this was a marvelous study. There's a physician at Long Beach VA is going to run it, and it's an angiographic study. They said, well, we can't help it. You don't seem to be qualified. Well, I was finally at my wit's end, and I thought upon one tactic. I called up my son Robert's employer, who is a cardiologist in New York, and I told him about the study. He says, well, when are you going to start your study? He says, I'm anxious to know what's going to happen to the angiograms. I says, we may never start it. He says, why not? I says, because I haven't raised $10,000 to hire a coordinator to run the study. He says, well, you know we can't help you for that. We're a diabetic foundation. I says, I'm not asking you for cash. I just want you to let me have Robert for 6 months on your salary. He said, well, that's a little different. I don't know. Maybe we can do it. I'll talk to our benefactor. He talked to his benefactor, and they approved it. The study started. I told Robert, Robert, you're going to live in Long Beach for 6 months, and you're going to be babysitter for 19 men who are 60 years old, as an average. We set up the place, started the study, and the study went along very well. I can't tell you all the problems. One example, what my first son, Robert, had to put up with. The men just couldn't get along with each other. If I've ever seen men act like children, it was in this study. Two of the men in their 60s, one with congestive heart failure, the other with serious angina, they got in a fist fight. They got in a fist fight, and they were beating on each other, and they put their arms around each other because they're both having such tremendous pain they couldn't move another arm, and they were hanging on to each other for dear life because of their tremendous angina. My son was trying to separate them, but they were so gasping for breath and so on that he could hardly get them apart. They were supporting each other. Well, he got them apart, and they both lay down on the floor. I thought one of them was going to die. Well, the problems he had really were tremendous. Some of the men despised each other because there's all levels of educational background. We had some who had only a third-year grammar school education, others were college graduates, and each one scoffed at the other. He had a real tough time. For a 23-year-old, he did a terrific job. And then the problem at the VA hospital, I can't start to tell you. They didn't like the idea of the study. So when I send 12 men in to have a blood test, they take their blood, but if they were busy, they didn't bother processing it until 5 o'clock, and at 5 o'clock, if they didn't process it yet, they throw it away. When I found that out, really, I was fit to be tied, but I couldn't do much about it. So I used to sneak my men in one at a time so they wouldn't know they belonged to my study. They were entitled to have their blood drawn. Well, it got so bad they wouldn't even let us do our treadmill testing. They made our physician do the treadmill testing only on his own time, evenings and weekends. It was a real tough time there, but we finally finished the study. The 5 months were over. I sent the men back to Loma Linda University, and Dr. Smith did the angiograms, and Dr. Smith called me up and he said, "Remember that truck driver that had that 80% closure in his left iliac artery?" I said, "I can't forget that artery." He says, "It's only 30% closed now." I said, 80 to 30%? It's not possible. He says, "Come and look for yourself." Well, I made that 60 miles from Long Beach to Loma Linda in Riverside in such time I never thought I'd get there alive myself. And I got there, I rushed into the radiological laboratory, and there on the light boxes were the original angiogram and the after angiogram. And you couldn't mistake the artery opening. It was so clear, from an 80% to 30%, it's unmistakable. And then he said, "Here's another spot to be interested in. Here's another spot." And we had about eight nice places in two patients that showed substantial closure and then opening. Well, that was remarkable. So I was very happy about that. And my physicians were very happy in the study. And they said, "We've got to tell everybody about this new therapy. We're able to take hypertensive patients, get them off their medication. Angina patients, get them off their problem. People on insulin, get them off insulin. We got to tell people about this." I said, "So what should we do?" They said, "Well, what you do is send it in to medical society meetings, and they print an abstract. That's a small paragraph or so telling what you've done, and then that gives people a right to ask for it to get more information. Then they usually let you talk about it at the medical meetings." And I said, "What medical meetings do you want to go to?" They said, "Well, the American Heart Association is having their meeting November 75. I said, "Well, on that meeting, the physicians ought to be the senior authors because they'll present the paper." They said, "Fine." And they said, "Well, there's a meeting out in Chicago. You can be the senior author." And it was a meeting of the American Academy of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation. I said, "It sounds very good." I said, "Fine." So the American Heart Association turned the physicians down with a routine form letter saying, "We're not really too interested." But in that year, they printed 1,000 abstracts, and one of them was, "The amount of cholesterol in the guinea pig's liver, much more important than our study, that was how to reverse hypertension to 75% of hypertensives on medication." The American Heart Association is not going to live that down. But the group out in Chicago accepted my paper and asked me to give it. And I went out to Chicago. The meeting was Atlanta. I gave my paper in Atlanta. And it was unusual in that nobody had ever heard of this before, that artery disease can be reversed. Their science editor, the Atlanta paper, wrote it up. The news services took it on. And in 2 days' time, I had a couple thousand inquiries back in Santa Barbara, where is this nutritional therapy possible? And I said, there's no place in the country where it's obtainable now. And I happen to think this would be an ideal time to put it in practice. If I wait for the medical community, it'll be 200 years. I better do it myself. And in a week's time, I made up my mind. In January 6th, 1976, our center opened with 9 patients and 6 spouses. Well, since then, it's enlarged a little bit. We've had over 3,000 people through our center. And we've had a lot of people investigate us. When McGovern wanted to hold his hearings last year, he first sent his chief of staff out to us in 1976 to investigate us. And the report came back that what we're doing is actually what we claim. So Senator Proxmire sent his investigative physician out to check us out. He came out and he said, well, I may need a couple of days to go through your case histories. Will you let me see everything you're doing? I says, all of our files are open to you. He stayed 3 weeks. He looked through every case we had. And he said, I was expecting, hopefully, to find 10% cures. I'm finding 70% cures. I can't believe it. He wrote a 180-page text for Senator Proxmire, and that was the basis of the McGovern hearings, 1977. And in the McGovern hearings, when they grilled Dr. Levy, director of the National Heart and Lung of National Institute of Health, there's 80 pages in the congressional record about that hearing. I've never been in a congressional record before, and suddenly now we have 80 pages. Well, the credibility that we've had, and I should say that in the beginning we had zero credibility, but it's completely different now. We have so much credibility now, and so many physicians are accepting what we're doing, I find it hard to believe. We probably have 10 or 15 physicians every day writing in for technical information about our studies and how to refer patients and so on. And now many people don't realize how much research we do. In 1977, we had about 20 people as an average on our research group. And we support medical research in various universities. UCLA, Loma Linda University, we have 5 studies going at the same time. University of Kentucky Medical Center, we've been supporting Dr. James Anderson for 3 years now. And we have other studies around the world. University of Alabama Medical School, we're doing a study. Dr. Burke in England, we're doing a study. We're doing a breast cancer study with Dr. Ernst Winder, American Health Foundation. We're doing a coronary angiogram study. We're going to have testing people having coronary angiograms on our diet. We're doing a tremendous amount of research. And I had never had envisioned that this thing would grow into what it is and the tremendous amount of research we're doing. And there's one thing I'm sort of thankful for, that perhaps I never had a boss and never had to worry about how to spend my own money doing research. Thank you.